This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
I want to look at the Torah's approach to work. Among secular philosophers throughout the ages, the philosophic view of man's need to work varies from it being an ideal, according to some, but they see in labor an ideal, and according to others, it's part of the tragedy of the human situation. What is the Torah's view? On the surface, the things that we see, there's quite a lot of conflict. Try and work out to what extent this is considered by the Torah as an ideal.
Vayikach Hashem Elokim et Adam, and Hashem took man, vayanicheinu began Eden, and he put him in the Garden of Eden, le'ovda u'le'shomra, to work the garden and to guard it. Says the Ovis Rabbi Nosson. Ovis Rabbi Nosson is similar to Pirkei Ovis, but it was edited by Rabbi Nosson, and he goes into a lot more detail. There's the same sort of order, and he brings similar Mishnahs, but on each concept, he brings a lot of different views and a lot of different angles. And one of the things he says here, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar says, "Af Adam Harishon." Even they're talking about, they're exalting the concept of labor here. This goes on the whole Mishnah of the Yafet Toran, Tomat Toran Perecheres, one needs to work, and it's Ehovet Hamlacha Osnahat Rabbanut, one should love working and hate positions of leadership where there's less work. And on all that, they're discussing the concept of melacha, and says Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, Adam HaRishon lo ta'am klum ad she'asa melacha. Even Adam HaRishon, even the first man, was not permitted to taste anything, to eat anything of the Garden of Eden. After all, he was in the Garden of Eden, the function of which was to give him to eat, that he had everything he needed around and about him. And even Adam HaRishon was not able to taste anything until he worked. She'ne'emar, as it says, Vayinichene began Eden lo'ovda lo'shomra. It says in the passage that I've just quoted you, and God put him in the Garden of Eden to work the garden and to keep the garden. Bahadar, and later on the Ribbono Shel Olam says to Adam, Mikol Etz Hagan Achol Tocham, now you may eat from all the trees of the garden. So you see that it's immoral to eat before you've worked. That's what Rabbi Tarfon says. Nothing for nothing. The difficulty with this statement of Rabbi Tarfon is, what does it say later on when Adam eats the wrong fruit? And he's cursed. What is one of his punishments? Now you're going to have to work for your food. That's what it happened just there. From the beginning he had to work for his food. That's the whole thing. We see that from the way God introduces him to the trees of the field, that he puts him there, la'avda, la'shomra, he puts him into the Garden of Eden to work the garden and to guard the garden, and that's what he's got to do in order to be able to eat, and he's not allowed to eat unless he puts that amount of work in. So what's the klola, what's the curse of b'zayas ha'pecha tzekalef, and so work a bit harder? It seems from the pasuk further on, that the curse of b'zayat ha'pecha toich alechem is not a quantitative curse. It's not just that up till now you had to work a little bit, now you'll work a little bit more. But that God is introducing a whole new style of life. And that must be what happened after the chet of Adam HaRishon. What's new about b'zayat ha'pecha toich alechem? We see that in the ideal state of the Gan Eden already, they had to work for their living. What does Rabbi Tarfon learn out of here? Sorry, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, not Rabbi Tarfon. He learns that there's a certain morality in working before you eat. And the Mefushim learn lots of things out of this. They learn that medically it's good, and spiritually it's good, and economically it's good. It's good from all sorts of points of view, but we won't discuss those. What we see from here is that morally it's good. Because even Adam HaRishon, even Adam in his ideal state, before the Chet, this was now the most ideal situation that the world could possibly be in. Right inside Gan Eden. Nevertheless, the Ribbono Shel Olam created the world in such a way that it was necessary for a man to work before he could eat. So you see, says Rabbi Tarfon, there's an ideal in labor, there's an ideal in work. What's the ideal? On these Mishnayot and Pirkei Avos about work, Rabbeinu Yonah comes up constantly And I think it's based on the Ovesta Rabbi Nosson that the importance of melacha, the importance of work, is to keep you busy. Because without that you come to batolo, you waste your time, and you become idle. And Rabbeinu Yonah says, once you're used to not working, it's very difficult to get into the habit again. That's one of the concepts of parents spoiling their children. That means at an early age, a parent teaches a child that you can get something without working for it. It's very difficult to ever unlearn that, eh, Richard?
Mm.
That is saying that you're smart. It's something we talked about. Pardon?
I'm just answering
the question. That's what it is. That right from the beginning, one isn't permitted to do anything for a child that a child is capable of doing itself. In the same way as the Ribbono Shel Olam was not prepared to do anything for Adam HaRishon, even at this stage, that Adam HaRishon was capable of doing himself. And when the child cries and wants its bottle, and its bottle is a couple of feet away, and the child knows how to roll over already, let the child roll to fetch the bottle. You don't have to come and fetch the bottle, because you're teaching them immorality. You're teaching the child theft by bringing the bottle to the child earlier. You're teaching the child that you don't have to put any effort in. You can lie where you are, and mommy will come and she'll bring you the bottle. And you'll never get that out of the child. It'll be very, very hard. You're teaching a basic degeneracy. You're introducing into the whole lifestyle of the child. So that's the one thing that Rabbeinu Yonah says, is one has to keep busy all the time. And if you're not busy all the time, you get into very bad habits. And also the importance of having a trade and earning a living so that you're not dependent on other people and so on and so forth, which is another thing that's already in the concept of Derech Eretz, of having a profession. But when Pirkei Avos talks about melacha, about the ideal of work, not having a profession, not for the earning of money, just work for the sake of work, Rabbeinu Yonah takes it to avoid batol. And in Ovesta Rabbi Nosson, in that same paragraph of Ovesta Rabbi Nosson that I was doing, which is Perek Yudalev, they say some frightening things, such as a sweeping statement by Rabbi Tarfon, Ein Adam Meit Ela Mitocha Batola, no man dies except out of boredom. And he goes through examples, he says, theoretically, if you could just keep a man busy on his deathbed, the Rabbeinu Shem doesn't take away people who are busy. The Malach HaMavis has to just distract them, so that they shouldn't be busy at that moment. And he says, what do you think, the strange thing, he says, what do you think a man dies from when he's falling off the skyscraper? You see a man falling off the Empire State Building, what do you think he's going to die from? He says, it's a mistake to think he's going to die from a broken back or a broken neck. He's going to die from batola. Because at those moments, if he was at least revising his Gemara at the time that he was falling down, maybe he would get away with it. But at the time of dying, one doesn't die unless one's bottle, unless one's not doing anything constructive. And Rabbi Tarfon and others bring this as examples of the extent to which the Ribbono Shel Olam regards work as a natural, inseparable part of our function in Olam Hazeh. Adam, the Omal Yula, man was created for work. That's it. We were put here to achieve. And in order to achieve, you've got to work. You can't get anything for nothing. That's the principle of this world. It's an old business principle which businessmen understand. When they come to shul, they don't understand it anymore. Nothing for nothing, that's it. Whatever you put in, that's what you get out. And there's nothing in this world for nothing. That's the essence of what Olam Hazeh is, right from the very beginning. The only thing is, up till now, we've always thought that that's the essence of what Olam Hazeh is after the Garden of Eden. But in the Garden of Eden, there was a principle of something for nothing. What I'm showing you now is that there was never a principle of something for nothing, not even in the Garden of Eden. That even in the most ideal state, there was still the essential principle that you get out what you put in. Your fruits are directly proportional to what you planted and how well you've looked after it. The interest on your investment is dependent on the size of your investment and on the way you've looked after your investment. It's as simple and as straightforward as that. The world, the Olam Hazeh, is simply a big lump of responsive material. You do something nice to it, something nice comes back to you. Simple as that. But then we're left with the question. So what's the curse of B'zeat HaPecha Tzorcha Lechem? What has God changed after the sin? That's what we've got to understand this evening. Is what changed in the situation of mankind after the sin? And what does it mean when God says B'zeat HaPecha Tzorcha Lechem, that you will work, you will have to earn your living with the sweat of your brow? The Netziv in Parashat Shlach Lecha, where the spies come back from the land, and Kalev and Yoshua come back and they say, don't listen to the 10 spies, ki tova ha'aretz ma'od ma'od, because the land is exceptionally good, ma'od ma'od, very, very good. After the Netziv, Why did I have to say the land is very, very good? Nobody's arguing about that. If you remember, the 10 spies didn't say the land was bad. They said it was too good. It was so good that it's producing people who are so strong and powerful that we, the people from the desert, are never going to be able to conquer that land. It's too strong. But there was no question about the value of the land. So what does Caleb and Joshua come along and they say, don't listen to them, the land's very good. They also said the land was very good. Says the Netziv, a wonderful chiddush, she says, ma'od, ma'od, in Bereishis here in our Sedra also, where the Torah uses the word ma'od, such as the Vayar Elokim ki Tova Haaretz ma'od, etc. It's complaints of the neighbors. The noise. There are various chazals about what that means, and one of them is that it means the Malach HaMavis, it means the angel of death, and one is that it means the Yetzer Hara. All things which are out of context considered evil and bad, death, Yetzer Hara, the Nachash, the snake that we heard about, all these things, and yet are referred to by the Torah as Tov Ma'od, as exceptionally good. It says in the Siddur, you see from there that what this word Ma'od means is that when they're put in context, when these things that on their own appear to be bad, when they're put into the correct context can be utilized correctly, that's what the Torah means when it uses the word Ma'od. And so says the Netziv, when the spies came back and they said, Ki tova ha'aretz ma'od, that the land is exceptionally good, what they meant is, don't listen to those people, to the 10 spies, the land is good. It's not good. Tova ha'aretz ma'od, it's very good. That means that you've got to work so hard for a living in Israel. It doesn't come easy like in South Africa and the rest of the place. There's a problem there, there's a difficulty there. And the difficulty is that the land is very responsive to punishment. It's a very sensitive land. And that if you're not working absolutely correctly, and if you're not keeping the Torah absolutely correctly, it hits you back so hard and so quickly that it's a dangerous land. But that is Tova, that's good. We'll discuss in a moment. And one sees, even today, that's what the land of Israel is. On the one hand, they've got the situations in Eretz Yisrael where you can work and work and you can't make a living. And on the other hand, you've got situations where you can sit in a kollel and you can make a living. You've got a situation where a man can open a makulis, he can open a falafel store. Who could make money over here? Can you imagine from opening a little falafel store on the corner of Warmer and 12th Avenue? How much are you going to earn? But there are people in Israel who become incredibly rich from a little falafel thing. They're not poor people, the guys who've got this falafel shop. They have to work hard, but they become really wealthy. And yet the wealthy people, the equivalent of our industrialists and entrepreneurs, are not as wealthy there as they are over here. What goes on? It's a funny land. It doesn't work on the same economic principles as any other land. If you're not keeping the Torah, it hits back hard. And you've got no Sunday, and you've got no Friday, and you've got no Shabbos, and you're working from morning till night. And you've got to go into the army for 3 months a year, and you've got to go into the army for a couple of years at a time, and there's one war after another war. It takes it out of you. If you're not living right. If you're living right, it's easy. You open a little falafel store, you serve in it for 2 hours a day, and you sit and learn for the rest of the day, and you make a living. That's the kind of place it is. And that's very good, says the Netziv. Because if the Ribbono Shel Olam sees that you're starting to mess around, and that you're taking things for granted, and that you're not using your time properly, it just makes you work a bit harder. It keeps you out of mischief that way. But Tova Haaretz Ma'od Ma'od means, says the Netziv, it has something which on the surface appears to be bad. That is, that you have to work very hard and you get punished very quickly. That's very good because it doesn't get you a chance to go off the tracks. Whereas in South Africa you can work and you can get more and more wealthy and become more and more superficial and more socially conscious and less particular about Shemitah HaMitzvot, about keeping the Torah, and less particular about learning and fixing times for learning. And as you become bigger, you become busier and you become smaller. That can't happen in Eretz Yisrael. You get hit too quickly. And that, says the Netziv over there, is the beauty of melacha, of work. It's in order to Rabbeinu Yonah, it keeps you out of mischief. And God can adjust the amount of work that you need according to how much mischief you need to be kept out of. If you don't need to be kept out of mischief, He'll organize things in such a way that you don't have to work hard and you can sit and learn for the rest of the time. If you do need to be kept out of mischief, He'll turn the screws on and you'll have to work a little bit harder. That will keep you out of mischief. So melacha is a wonderful valve, a wonderful gauge to keep you out of trouble. The thing then comes out that melacha, work, is not considered noble for its own sake. According according to all the Mephoshim that I brought you, Melacha is simply good in the sense of the end which it serves. And basically that's an end of keeping you straight, of keeping you out of trouble. Melacha is one of the ways that you keep out of trouble, and that's in fact what they say in Pirkei Avot, Sheyegiat Shnehem Mishkachat Avon, that by not only learning Torah but having a bit of Melacha as well, having to work as well, it keeps sin away. That's the thing that keeps you out of trouble. So we see that Melacha is nothing to be idolized for as an end in itself, a man must work, etc., etc. It's just something that one needs in order to stay straight. In that case, in what area does one's Melacha have to be? What would happen if a person is working Melacha hard, and to get an idea of Melacha, there's a Gemara in Psochim which says that earning a living is twice as hard as the birth pains of having a child, right? And that's very hard, and there's a difference. The birth pains of having a child last for a couple of hours. The pains of earning a living are permanent, and one doesn't realize, unless one's sensitive enough, the pain and suffering that really goes into earning a living. That's the Chazal say that if one puts that kind of effort into Torah, let's say, right, you put in as much effort that you're suffering, the pain you're experiencing because you're working so hard, is twice as much as a woman experiences in childbirth. Are you yotzei your chiyuv of working? Is it possible that you don't need to work in any other area? If we would say that work is idolized as a sense, as an idea in its own sense and in its own right, then no, you would always have to work. Melacha is something that one needs. But if you say that melacha is just something which keeps you out of mischief, then if you're keeping yourself out of mischief without melacha, you shouldn't have to work. That's the natural logical consequence of what we've learned so far. And it is so. The grammar in the sentence is very strange. It says, "Vayikach Hashem Elokim et Adam," and God took man, "Vayanicheinu began Eden," and he put him in the Garden of Eden, which is a masculine noun. The Garden of Eden is masculine, not feminine, to work her and to keep her, feminine. And there are various pshatim about this, what this means, but the Sifri in Akev takes it for granted and simple that La'ovda or La'shomra is referring to the Torah and mitzvahs, and it's not referring to looking after the garden. The garden doesn't have to be looked after. Now we understand an incredible thing. The taka work is needed. And Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar is right. They're not allowed to eat until they've worked. But the work doesn't have to be in the garden. The work can be in the Beis HaMedrash too. As long as you're working, you've been put here to work, work, work all the time, from the time you're born until the time you die. That's what you're here for. There's no retirement on this world, and there's no manucha on this world. There's no time for rest here. Unless your rest is in order to enable you to work better tomorrow, and in order to take a holiday in order to come back refreshed. That's the only right we have, to take a rest and to take a break. Otherwise, as long as we're living, the purpose is to work, work, achieve, achieve, achieve. And you're not allowed to eat until you've worked. You're not allowed to take anything out of this world until you've worked for it. But that work doesn't have to be in the world, according to this. The work could be l'ovdal l'shomra. It could be to keep and to guard the Torah. And I've always had difficulty with the Sifri. If that's what it means, why doesn't it say so? Why does it use strange grammar? And from that we've got to work out that what it means is looking after the Torah and not looking after the garden. But the answer now is very clear, because it means either. L'ovdal l'shomra means you've got to work. Preferably in Torah, but not essentially in Torah. You want to work in the garden? Work in the garden. But you've got to work somewhere. You have the option to work in Torah, because the purpose of work is to keep you constructive, to keep you achieving, and to keep you out of mischief and out of trouble. I want to explain to you now how it's possible to achieve the benefits of work without working in the garden. After all, the concept is that you don't get anything for nothing. So I understand, you want to eat a tomato, you've got to plant the tomato. How can it work that you learn a Rashi and then you can eat the tomato? What's the connection? What's it all about? A lot of my thinking over the past two years has been based on two major works. Two of the only major works he's really written of Rabbi Yoshe Ben Soloveitchik in the United States. One of them is called Ish HaHalacha, where he describes the nature of the man whom he calls the Ish HaHalacha, the man of Halacha. It's an incredible work. It's something exceptionally great. That one and the other one that he wrote also, The Lonely Man of Faith, are two gigantic works of philosophy, the likes of which have not been written in modern Torah and unlikely in anything else. This is something just quite exceptional. in stature, and they're not written, they weren't written recently. The Isha Halakha was written in the 1940s, it was written quite a while ago, but it's only now been published. You never allowed it to be published before. Whether one agrees with the old Litvish system of Avodas Hashem or one doesn't is one story. But one thing, after studying this work of J.B. Soloveitchik, I'm prepared to say, nobody has a right to criticize that system unless they've studied that work of J.B. Soloveitchik, which is not only a defense of that system, but it's a glorification of that system. Although he himself is not quite part of it, whatever it is, he writes it as an explanation of a whole approach in Avodas Hashem, which started with, not with the Vilna Gaon, but really was typified by the Vilna Gaon and carried on by his Talmidim right through the period until the Second World War. And that's the approach which he describes there in a most incredible way. And one of the things in describing one of the aspects of the Isha Halakha, he explains the following. He says you can have two kinds of scientists. And I think the best area that one can understand this in is in the area of economics. An economist, an MBA, a scientist in business science, is called in to put a business right. There are two ways he can do it. The one way is he goes into the business and he starts seeing what the business does, and he works with the business, and he works in the various different departments, and he opens his eyes and he notices what's right and what's wrong, and he keeps his eyes open, and as he goes through he starts noticing where things could be improved. And after a period of time, when he's got a feel of the business and an understanding of the business, he sits down and he writes a report to restructure the business on a more streamlined fashion. That's the way one scientist works. Another scientist says, works completely differently. He says, I'm not okay, you want me to do that? I'll see you in a year's time. I won't come to your business for another year. I'll see you in a year's time. What does he do for the year? He sits and he works theoretically, and he knows it's theoretically, ideally how should such a business operate. He doesn't want to be contaminated by the problems they've got already. He doesn't want his thinking to be restricted by the way they've gone about things. He closes himself off in his study, and for a year he sits down there with all his principles and all of his theories, and he sits and he constructs, he works out what are the aims of such and such a business. Right, this is the way a business should be set up to deal with that, and he constructs an ideal model, the way it should really be, although in practice maybe that's not possible, but he constructs the model. And that is the system of scientific investigation which Rabbi Yoshe Ben Soloveitchik calls approaching it with an a priori model. Well, one can understand it also before that. The thrill that the second scientist finds in his work is in his study. That's where the excitement's going on. While he's busy constructing this ideal model, while he's busy working out a system, while he's busy working out ideally how it should operate, that's where he's up in the clouds. That's where he's really enjoying himself and having a wonderful time. Then he comes to the business after a year, and he takes his model, he comes with his model, and he starts checking up. Why doesn't that operate like this, and why doesn't this operate like this, and this should be like this. He's got a basis to start from. He's got a premise to start from. He's not walking into a strange world where he knows nothing. He's coming in as a specialist. He's coming in as a man, in fact, who's designed a business better than this business already. He's coming in as a mumche, as an absolute specialist. And then there's also a thrill in seeing the actualization of his model. And he tries to understand why it can't work in this business exactly as he's modeled it. And then he starts compromising to work out how he can still retain the principles of his ideal in the unfortunate circumstances of the business he's really investigating. And that also is a source of fulfillment for him. But not as beautiful if he's an academic, if he's an intellectual. Then the beauty of his action is all the construction of the model in preparation of walking into the business. One sees it with a child as well. You want to teach a child what a fish is. So you can take a child to an aquarium and say that is a fish. Or you can teach a child a picture of a fish and take out the child's encyclopedia and show him pictures of different fishes and study the articles with him and build him up that he gets tremendous theoretical knowledge of fishes. Where they come from and how they evolved and their colours and the different types of fish and what the fins are called and which fish have scales and which haven't. And then you can teach him the halachic implications of scales and fins and kosher fish and not kosher fish and scavengers and non-scavengers, and you can classify them at all before you show him a fish. And he gets a tremendous thrill from this if you approach it right. That he's going crazy with all this knowledge. And then you're going to say, there's a fish. What kind of fish is that? and his mind starts ticking over. It's a kosher one or it's not a kosher one. And it's a deep sea one or it's not a deep sea one. Or it's a freshwater one. And it's a tropical one or it's not a tropical one. And he's using his intellect, all that fun that he had with you on the floor with all those encyclopedias and articles open, he's now using and operating, and he's getting a thrill out of seeing the actualization of all that knowledge. That's the one way of doing it. And for an intellectual, for a child with intellectual ability, his father's superior way of spoiling it for him by saying, you want to see where the fish is? Come, we'll go and look at a fish. That's for the primitive one who doesn't have the ability to conceptualize. What happens if you study with him about rockets? Rockets and satellites. And he's never going to see a rocket, he's never going to see a satellite. Doesn't matter. He'll have the same thrill of learning about it and opening books about it and theories about it and the history of it and what it is and how it operates. He has the same thrill the child does. If one day he'll see a rocket, it will be a lovely pleasure. If it doesn't, okay, it doesn't matter. All that he needs to know is that it's practicable, that it's real, that there are such things. Or even if you taught him about rockets before 1957, he would still have a thrill, the fact that there could be a rocket, the fact that people are working on it, that theoretically it's possible. Doesn't matter if at that stage there isn't even such a thing as a rocket, there isn't even such a thing as a satellite. Yet he's having a tremendous thrill in conceptualizing, in studying what it could mean to have such things. And that, says to Rabbi Yosef Ben Soloveitchik, is really the line of the second scientist. He's working in an ideal system in his study, and he's learning the most fantastic ideals and systems and formula. That's where he's having the real fun. And he'll try and put it into practice. He says that's how the Ish HaLacha learns Torah. When he's learning an Inyan and Halacha, when he's learning a matter of Halacha, he's learning an ideal system. And Torah, with a capital T, is that ideal system. And that's where he's created. And he tries it this way, and he tries it that way, and he constructs and he builds, and he starts with a Gemara, and with a Chumash, and with a Tanakh, and with a Rambam, and with a Rif, and a Raivas, and a Rosh, and he builds it up, and Tur, and Shulchan Aruch, and Poskim, and he builds and builds and builds, until he has an ideal system, an ideal model. And then he goes out into the world, and he applies it. What happens if the subject he happens to be learning about is korbanot, sacrifices? You can't bring a sacrifice now. It's not practical. It doesn't bother him. It's like the child learning about a rocket. It will be practical one day. He's knowing about it. He's learning about it. He's learning how you bring a korban, what a korban is, why this kind and not that kind, and how you shift it, and how you bring the blood, and how you do this, and what the kohen has to look like when he does it, and what he must be dressed in, and what the people have to say, and what the people have to do. And he's working ideally. How do you ideally bring such and such a korban? And now he's a specialist. He knows exactly how you bring such a korban. When Mashiach comes and the korban is really brought, he'll have additional thrill. But the fact that Mashiach is not yet here doesn't detract from his present thrill. The fact that the child is able to see the fish in the water ultimately, that's a new thrill and a wonderful thrill. But learning about a rocket before there's such a thing as a rocket, still it's a wonderful thrill and it's very important for the child in order to relate to reality. And so says Rabbi Yosef Ben Soloveitchik, that's the importance that that system of learning is always put on Talmud Torah. Learning, 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 because that's where you develop your ideals, that's where you see the world as it really should be. And that equips you to come out into the world as in reality, and be able to approach it from a point of view of objective correctness, how it really should be, and not to start off with a compromise. If you start off your knowledge of the Torah by being in the world, if you start off out in a world which is an inadequate world, and that's where you learn Torah, it's no good. It's like we said last Shabbos, you've got to design your sukkah inside the Beis HaMidrash. That's where you've got to work out the plans. You can't go outside and design your sukkah, because your sukkah won't stand up. Your sukkah will be a compromise. It will be something not secure. The beauty of the generation, of the world, before the sin of Adam, is that the outside reality matched up ideally with the inside Torah. That's what was fantastic. That the scientist is sitting there and he's working out his ideal model, and imagine he's thrilled if he comes to the business and it's exactly the same. Every detail that he's worked out in the Beis HaMidrash, in his studies, exactly how the business should operate. You can't, that's how they're doing it. Everything is exactly right. Imagine what a thrill that is. Imagine the child who learns about the fish. You go to show the child that the real fish, sometimes it's a bit of a disappointment for the child. Because he was working already, he was thinking of something that was absolutely ideal, and the colors were brighter, and the fish had a smile on its face, whereas this fish doesn't, it's got quite an ugly face, and the fish swam faster in his mind, and here the fish is swimming slower. Sometimes the reality is a disappointment. Imagine when the child comes and it's exactly as he learned. It's an incredible thrill. To get it just right, and to see the world operating just right, that's fantastic. But that economist, let's say, whose child is called in, we want you, not, let's say, not to put the business right. The business hasn't got problems, but we're planning progress, we're planning expansion, and we want you, Mr. MBA, to tell us how to expand. So he says the same. I'll see you in a year's time. And he works for this year, and he slaves and he sweats in construction. But the problem is that we're planning progress, we're planning expansion, and we want you, Mr. MBA, to tell us how to expand. So he says the same. I'll see you in a year's time. And he works for this year, and he slaves and he sweats in constructing the ideal model of the business to where it is, and the ideal model of where it should go from there. And now he's as worried as anything, because now he's got his two models. The one is the business as it is, and the one is the business as to where it should go. Now, if the business is not anything like it should be, then he's got a lot of work to do before he can even start the expansion. And he walks in on the first day after 1 year with his model, his file of papers, and he starts studying the business in reality. And it's exactly as he worked it out. Everything works exactly using the same system. It's the ideal model. That's what it is. Then it's simple. And this is where Mr. Managing Director, here are the rest of the plans. You just carry on this way. Everything's fine. My work's over. So where did all his work go? All his work went on in his study. All his work went on with theory. And when he comes into the real business, there's nothing to do because it's all right. That's what Gan Eden was. Once you've learnt in the Beis HaMedrash, once you've learnt the Sugya, you come into the world, you come into the Garden of Eden, there's nothing to do. So you just got to put it into practice. You plant the seed, you cut it, whatever it is. Simple. You do it, the world gives back. There was no tremendous amount of work that had to be done. What happened later on? B'zayat ha-pecha tuchal lechem. It's told you have to eat bread by the sweat of your brow. There's a fantastic hirsch on this sentence, where he shows that the word apecha is not panecha, it's not your face. Apecha is the spiritual, intellectual part of the human being. That's all Hirsch says there. But you know what that means. That opens a new world. What the claw is, what the curse is, you've now got to use your head to earn a living. Before, you didn't have to use your head to earn a living. You used your head in the Beis HaMedrash, and when you came out into the world, you just had to put it into practice. You learned in the Beis HaMedrash that you've got to plant in the spring, so you plant in the spring, you wait, the rains come down, you reap, and you've got it. You learnt it all, and it all works exactly as you learnt it. Now there's a new concept. Even when you go out of the Beis HaMedrash, you've got to use your head. You've got to use your intellect to work out how to use the world. What's happened? What's changed? What's changed? Why all of a sudden? The world has changed. Now the world no longer matches the Beis HaMedrash.
Really, very simple.
What you learned in the Beis HaMedrash now no longer applies exactly the same in the world. So the economist has been busy with his plan in his study. The plan's the same. The Torah hasn't changed. The ideals haven't changed. The formulas, the systems haven't changed. And the man has worked out his system, but now when you come out of the Beis HaMedrash, the system doesn't work. Because the business has gone to pot. The business has deteriorated. The business is no longer what it used to be. And the business is no longer subscribing to those ideals which you've worked out should have subscribed to. And in fact, it creates heartache. A man develops such a beautiful plan inside his study, and he goes out into the business and he finds that there's corruption, that the systems aren't working, and that they're not using the right systems, the whole thing's a mess. To an aesthetic, to a person who appreciates beauty and intellect, that's so sad. He looks at his model, he looks at his file of papers, and it's so beautiful, and it's so perfect, and it's so balanced. and he comes into the business and it's such a mess and it's so disorganized and it's so ugly, it hurts his feeling of aesthetics, it hurts his feeling of beauty, of nobility, apart from anything else. That's the anguish that Adam was put to after eating from the Eitz Hadaat. But having gone out, now you can still learn in the Beis HaMedrash the same. But when you go out, your work hasn't stopped. There's still tremendous work now in applying the model to the world outside, because the world no longer is adapted to your model. And that's the chidush, that's what happened new after the Chet, after the sin of Adam HaRishon. And that really is the concept that we've discussed in previous weeks, of the theoretical different roles of a Rosh Yeshiva and a Rav, in a sense. That there was no such distinction in the Gan Eden stage. Because what did the Rosh Yeshiva occupy himself? With the learning of the model. He learns Torah as it is, that's all. A Rav basically has to apply the principles of Torah to non-ideal situations. He has to take the ideal situation of Torah and make it work in a non-ideal situation. And that involves applying and adapting and twisting in a positive sense, not distorting, but bending and flexing and working and working and working to make the thing work in reality. That's something that today Rosh Yeshiva doesn't like doing. That's all. Rosh Yeshiva likes learning the Gemara as it is, and learning the Shulchan Aruch as it is, not adapting it to the real situation. So that is a rov, that's another job altogether. That concept of having to work for adaption is something which only happened at the curse of the Zayat HaPech HaTorech HaLechem. Now you have to work with your intellect. Not only do you have to work with your body to earn bread, but you've got to work with your intellect, not only in the Beis HaMedrash, whereas previously L'Ovda or L'Shomra could have been interpreted as working in the Beis HaMedrash as the Sifri really interpreted. All that's important is that you're working. Preferably that you're working in Torah, and that's why L'Ovda L'Shomra is written in the feminine, so as to match up with Torah. Now there's no mistaking. B'zayat HaPech HaTorech HaLechem. Your work and labor is now going to go into eating, it's going to go into your practical application of Torah in the world. And it's B'zayat HaPech HaTorech, your intellect is going to sweat, not just your body. The beauty of all this is that, contrary to all other interpretations of the Torah, man has undergone no change. This is also a point which Hirsch points out. But man has not been cursed at all. There's no klala on man. The klala is all on the environment. It's society. It's not even society. It's the environment. It's the stage on which we're acting which has been changed. But we are born with the same kind of potential as Adam HaRishon was born. We are born with the same potential greatness, and the same things are expected of us as was expected from Adam HaRishon, because there's no change in our ability. There's no change in our powers. There's no change in our potential purity. The only thing that has changed is, now you have to work outside the Beis HaMedrash. Why? Because outside the Beis HaMedrash no longer fits in, no longer is adapted automatically to the ideal system of the Beis HaMedrash. And one sees from this a concept that people find difficult to understand. That is the relationship between a Beis HaMedrash and the outside world. Apart from where one's holding, and apart from where one finds oneself, there should be times in one's life, regularly, where one gets back into the Garden of Eden situation. Otherwise you can't operate. If we're put here with Adam's ability and with Adam's potential, and the same things are expected of us, except what? The environment is no longer adapted, so we have to put in tremendous effort into applying Torah correctly to the outside world. You can no longer just take it out of the Beis HaMedrash and apply it as it is. It needs to be tempered and it needs to be flexed in order to be applied properly. How can we achieve those standards? So we should at least have situations in our lives where we can run back into the Garden of Eden. Those situations are Shabbos. The concept of Ma'ein Olam Haba. Olam Haba doesn't mean the world to come after you're dead. Olam Haba is when we get back to the Gan Eden situation. The world to come after your death is Olam HaEmet, that's something else. But Olam Haba is when this world will again match up to the ideal situation. That's what the concept of Olam Haba is. Shabbos is Me'ein Olam Haba. Because now where do you work? You still work on Shabbos. But not outside. That's the whole concept of a Malacha on Shabbos, of not doing certain things on Shabbos. What are the things that are prohibited in Shabbos? All the things which go into applying the principles of Torah to an inadequate world. That's what goes into those are the things that you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. Your malacha has to be la'oz da'u l'shomra in the feminine. You've got to work the Torah. There's no ideal in malacha on Shabbos. That's it. So we get back to the Garden of Eden situation before the chet. And it's an ideal set up Shabbos. And we sit with our families and we learn and there's nothing to disturb us and there's nothing to distract us and we have no excuse whatever on Shabbos not to be great. And we're told in fact that one has a koach hachidush, one is able to understand things in Torah on a Shabbos which one isn't able to understand during the week because of this purity, this situation we find ourselves of being in an ideal world. And in addition to that we have a Beis HaMidrash. I don't mean a physical Beis HaMidrash, I mean when you're sitting and learning. When you're sitting and learning, you again should find yourself leaving the inadequate world and coming into a situation which is ideal, a situation which matches perfectly what the Torah is in the ideal system. And a Beis HaMidrash in a physical sense is really an expression of that. What we try and do in our own homes, and on our own homes if we're on the level and if we can get to the level, and in a Beis HaMidrash irrespective of whether we're on the level, is we try and recreate the Garden of Eden here. That there should be no need inside one's home or inside one's Beis HaMidrash to compromise what one's learnt to what one applies. Outside one has to do all sorts of things to make it work. But inside the Beis HaMidrash and inside one's home, one should be able to move directly from learning to application. With Chochmah, obviously, you have to apply it with a bit of sense and understand how to apply it, particularly in a home situation. But in the Beis HaMidrash, there should be no problem. The standards of the Beis HaMidrash, the systems of the Beis HaMidrash, the lifestyle of the Beis HaMidrash should all be the lifestyles of the ideal Torah system, even if outside the Beis HaMidrash, those ideal systems are completely impractical. And that's why it's not hypocritical for a person who drives to shul not to park his car in front of a shul. Why is it not hypocritical? Because I drive, I know it, everybody knows it. But there's no reason that I have to disturb the shul. A guy who comes out of shul or a guy who's in shul wants to come out, he wants to, at least on Shabbos, he wants to be, forget that the world is inadequate. That's what he wants on Shabbos. My driving up reminds him that the world is inadequate and it destroys his Shabbos totally. So the man who parks down the road is being sensitive to what a shul is all about. And he's saying to himself, I want that too. When I come into a shul, I also want to feel that the world is ideal and I want to forget that I drive. Otherwise, what's it all about? And that's the difference between an Orthodox shul and a Reform shul. Both drive to shul. What's the difference? The Reform shul makes the shul part of the world. Makes the temple part of the world. It's interesting that they use the word temple. We use the word Beit HaKnesset, gathering place. Right, temple. And they do exactly the opposite. They make the shul into something ordinary. The shul is the sum total of the standards of those people who participate. If we're all mechalalei Shabbos, if none of us keep Shabbos, the shul won't keep Shabbos. None of us keep kashrus, the shul won't keep kashrus. And you have the form shuls in America where they do keep kashrus, they do keep Shabbos. It just depends on who's there, on who the participants happen to be. What's an Orthodox shul? It's not the participants who fix the standard, the Torah fixes the standard. And you jolly well subscribe to it if you want to be part of it. So that at least you can come in and forget that you're not on the standard. Forget that you're part of a world which is not yet ideal. And at least you can devote yourself to Torah in a way which is ideal. That's something very special and very essential to the whole concept of what a shul is and what a Shabbos is and what a Beis HaMidrash is and what the learning of Torah is. And something without which we find ourselves confusing these two situations, the situation before the sin and after the sin, into such a confusion we will never be able to untangle it, and we'll never be able to live a life of purity, and we'll never be able to live a practical life. We'll just live a life of total chaos and mess. Unless we clearly understand this is the ideal as it should be, and we have clarity in that, and we try then as best as we can in our sukkahs, we take our sukkahs out with us, and we try from our sukkahs to apply that ideal to the world around us, that's the way to operate. But never chas v'sholem to try and bring the inadequacies of the world into one's intimate relationship with the Torah itself. Any questions on that quickly before we go? Because this is very, very important. And this is I don't know about all the universities, but I don't know. It's certainly the case of Orthodoxy.